5.5 hour flight in the middle of the winter. And the plane had an engine problem while we were flying there. It started to sputter. And there was a Russian pilot over the intercom telling us something. And I figured it was probably, we're all gonna die.
Hello, and welcome to the brand spanking new podcast, Drinks with a VC. I'm Vic LaQuara, the co-founder and managing director of Seed Stage Fund, Green Cow Venture Capital. And I am joined by my friend and co-hostess with the mostest, Bree Hansen. She heads up business development for Berkeland & Associates, a firm that provides CFO, accounting, and tax services for startups. Bree?
Thanks, Vic. Before we start the show, two disclaimers. The first disclaimer is this is not your typical venture podcast. Over the next hour, you won't find answers to questions like, what is your focus? What is your average check size? At what stage do you invest? We assume that you, the listener or viewer, can do all that homework using your favorite search engine.
You will, however, find answers to these questions. What makes our guest tick? Does this investor have a soul? Do I want to get into a 7 to 10 year relationship with this person? We'll even touch on some hot button topics and current events, and of course, get insights and opinions from our guest on where they think we're all headed.
The second disclaimer, yes, guests and interviewers do consume alcoholic drinks during the taping of our show. We do so responsibly and ask that everyone do so as well.
And only if you're of legal drinking age.
And definitely not operating a motor vehicle, no White Claws and scooting, and I'm talking to you, Santa Monica. And now we hope you enjoy our first episode.
All right, well, this is very exciting, Bree. We're finally here, the time has come. Are you excited?
Absolutely, it's crazy. The day of our first taping is actually here.
Do you remember how many people and how much time we spent combing through our contacts to find just the right guest for the kickoff show?
Oh my God, yes. The list was hundreds of VCs long and filled with really fascinating people. In the end, we wanted to find someone who really showcased what this podcast represents.
You mean diversity and inclusion?
No, our first guest is definitely a white guy.
Right, well, we'll work on that for future episodes.
Yes, we will. Our first guest needed to embrace being totally open and genuine because our goal is to get much more than a superficial glimpse into the life of a venture capitalist. This guest also needed to be laid back, not take themselves too seriously, and be ready to roll with the miscues and the jitters that comes with the first episode. So I think we found that person.
Absolutely. I mean, to preface this, he instantly got the podcast concept, really embraced the novelty of it all. And we're sure he's going to make a fantastic guinea pig. So without further delay, I'd like to introduce to you all Scott Beechuk, partner at Norwest Ventures and particularly highly regarded by our enterprise investor peers and founders alike. He is a board member of Blue Corp, Lean Plum, Mind Tickle, Qualified, Singular, and Socrates AI. He's born and raised in Michigan and zooming all the way in from post-apocalyptic San Francisco, where he lives with his wife, Wei Ping. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Wow, thank you so much. What an intro. And I feel like even before we get started, I have way more to live up to than I ever possibly could. So thank you for the setup.
That sounds like what 2020 was about. And then look at how it delivered for all of us. So it's always good to see you, Scott. It's great to have you on as our first guest.
Well, thank you so much. It is an honor. And this being the first show, I can't imagine what's going to happen, but I do thank you for trusting me to be your first guest. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Well, let's get started, shall we?
Let's do it.
All right. So by most accounts, 2020 was and has been a horrible year for most, so much so that I often really struggle to find words for it. On that note, if you were going to describe 2020 thus far with one picture, what would it be a picture of?
It would probably be a picture of Alfred E. Newman throwing himself off a cliff. I mean, you know, we went into this year with, I think, a lot of optimism, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, it's 2020. Yeah. It's the beginning of a new decade. What could be better than that?
Absolutely.
But then all of a sudden, things went a little sideways and people lost their front tooth. And it seemed like there might be a chance that this was just all over. And maybe it would just be like this funny thing we look back on. But then very quickly, we realized we were actually all jumping off a cliff.
Whew. Yeah, I think that perfectly encapsulates most people's mindsets. And yes, Bree, something that I will absolutely bring to.
I like that one. That was a really good description.
I think mine would have been dumpster fire, but either way, it's fantastic.
Well, you know, I mean, Alfred E. Newman's famous quote was, you know, what, me worry? I think he's worried. I actually think he's worried for the first time ever.
Absolutely. We're all just a little bit worried, particularly leading up to the election coming up.
Indeed.
Absolutely. And speaking of this is Drinks with a VC, Scott. So why don't you tell us what you picked for us to make together here tonight?
Well, thank you, by the way, for providing the provisions to make this delicious cocktail that we were able to make together. What we did is we decided on a classic, an old classic that even a guy like me, who's just terrible in the kitchen, could master somehow. And that's an old fashioned. An old fashioned is a straightforward cocktail consisting of just a few ingredients. We've got, you know, you need a little bit of orange in there. You know, you need some bitters in the mix there. You need a sugar cube or two, you know, some nice bourbon or whiskey. Maybe some maraschino cherries. I think we've got a few here. Anyway, I don't want to go into all the details, but you kind of mash it all together. You choose a nice cube, throw it in a glass, and with any luck, you've got something that's drinkable. So, hey, you know what? It's a perfect 2020 drink. We can't mess this up.
Can't mess it up. We can't mess it up. Is this something that you drink at home regularly, or do you go out to bars typically pre-COVID?
You know, I don't drink a lot of cocktails. I'll be really like, I could just pretend like I'm cooler than I am. But if I do drink a cocktail, it's usually, you know, maybe a couple times a month. And yes, this is the kind of drink that I might make at home. Although thank you to Berkeley and Associates for delivering the provisions, because I don't usually have all this stuff here sitting around. A bar. Yeah, I'll order one of these now and then at a bar. Yeah, it's always a good standby, right?
So after COVID, when this thing's over and you get to travel somewhere, where are you going to drink an old fashioned?
Well, I think one of the things we talked about before was, you know, the low bar nature of our expectations in 2020. And one of the things that I'm really looking forward to, and I haven't done yet, is traveling outside of California. I mean, what a treat that would be, you know, go right? Somewhere else. So I don't know. I mean, my wife and I, we've talked about maybe, you know, going to somewhere on the East Coast if we're that brave, maybe go to Austin, her old stomping grounds. So yeah, maybe one of those two places, you know, maybe Miami, maybe Austin. Those are two thoughts that we had.
All right. But yeah. We're in COVID right now. So, you know, one of the things that I've been asked multiple times is sort of, what is the one item that you've bought online that's under $100 on Amazon that has really changed your COVID life?
Well, my COVID life needed a lot of changing, I'll be honest. There wasn't a lot good going on at first. In fact, I was going a little crazy. And so then I'm going to show you right now, and you see me reaching down because that's exactly where this item comes from. I found one of the most amazing, the most amazing items you can find on Amazon for under $100 that changed my life, not just during COVID, but I suspect post-COVID as well. And it is this wonderful UGG slipper.
Oh, nice.
What was once a wool covered boot, mostly for women, has now become an equal opportunity slipper for men. And quite frankly, this is also an omnisex slipper. My wife actually loves wearing these, even though her shoe size is probably like 7 sizes smaller than mine. They still work and they have memory foam.
So Scott, I know UGG boots are oftentimes, they're associated with strippers in Vegas wearing Juicy Couture. you're like, ah, but really they came from Australian surfers. So being a cool Aussie surfer with your cool wool from the sheepskin of New Zealand and Australia, you know. So that's really what you're more in line with are those cool surfers, not really the ladies' boot for the, you know.
You are giving me way too much credit, Bree, and I appreciate that because I can use all the help I can get. There is nothing cool about wearing these at all. In fact,
you're not Crocs.
I know this is not about, you know, investing and, you know, VC stuff, but there was this opportunity that I had this year. We signed a term sheet with Replicant, which is another company that I invested in. And the CEO, Gotti, he and I wanted to sign this term sheet together in person, but we had to do it in a socially distanced way. So we went to the rooftop of our house on a semi-foggy day, and my wife took a picture of us signing this term sheet together. Now, everything seemed great for a second, because we just thought, hey, we'll have this picture, right? And then Forbes magazine wanted to run an article on this deal, and guess who is in a pair of UGG slippers on Forbes.com?
Wow.
This idiot. It was embarrassing. I mean, they don't look that good, and they never were intended to. They're just comfortable, you know? But hey, for under $100 on Amazon, that's, I guess, it's the thing that changed my life the most.
I also just want to point out to our listeners and our viewers at this point that you had no prompt for this question. And this is not one of those examples of product placement. We're not looking for free Uggs here.
I don't even know if it's possible to own UGG stock. I'm even not sure if that's a thing.
I don't know if it's a thing, but let me tell you, after this, I bet you UGG stocks would be trending up, right?
I think they're like, hey, Scott Pichuk promoted UGGs. They're like, I'm going to short that thing now.
I got mine too on NordstromRack.com. These are my UGGs. Also one of my favorite purchases. So you are not alone.
Lovely.
And if UGGs wants to send us some free shit, that's great.
Yeah, to the listeners out there, I've already rolled my eyes twice now, and I do not condone this UGGs product placement. I really don't.
Hey, Vic, check your mailbox this coming Monday. You never know what might be waiting for you.
Oh, man. All right. Okay. Let's get back to drinking. Is the old fashioned and your love for the old fashioned... And I also believe that you're a big fan of shaken, not stirred martinis a la Bond. Is your drink of choice the most pretentious thing about you? I've known you only for a short period of time, but I honestly feel like that might be the case.
Well, if you think that drinking a glass of straight chill gin is pretentious, then I think we need to talk. Because look, I'm not a fancy guy, but... As far as I can tell, making gin cold and putting it into a glass and then drinking it, that doesn't seem too fancy to me.
You know, it's not fancy in terms of the number of ingredients, et cetera. It's the way that you order it, right? It's the one or two kind of directions that you give the bartender that's already saying, look, dude, just order a beer, just order a glass of wine, make it fast for me. I've got a full bar, right? And I don't know.
Well, if I show up to a bar by accident wearing a Patagonia vest and I order that drink, I usually get like peanut butter and some sort of low-end whiskey in a cup anyway. I mean, that's just, I'm used to that.
Whatever sludge they give you after that.
Whatever sludge, and I deserve it, you know, for having done that. That's fair. I mean, look, I'll never be James Bond. There are certain drinks out there that I am certain that certain like of these mixologists in the world would say, that's a pretty cool drink. I don't know those drinks. I'm not even sure what those are. I couldn't name them. There's a lot of classics out there.
Yeah.
A lot of new ones. I don't know.
I think, you know, speaking of pretentiousness, and I've known you to be a very down-to-earth human being, generally. I think what's more telling is that...
Was that a disclaimer?
No. Maybe. I think what's more telling, though, about you personally is how much of a chameleon you've been throughout your whole career. I'm just going to go ahead and list this off. So this is the running list of jobs you've had. A country club busboy. You've been an embedding system software developer, a sales rep, a music producer, a CEO, a sales engineer, a janitor, and a public company executive. And my first kind of thought and kind of question to you really is that, is this out of pure hustle, necessity, upbringing, or maybe just some seemingly never-ending pursuit to experience everything and discover yourself? What is that about? Like, normally, if you look at my resume, it's not that intriguing or involved, and it's not so spread out and diverse. So what's behind that?
Well, first of all, I'll just say it wasn't intentional. But second of all, I'll say that the jobs in that list where I actually got fired are probably the ones that would be the best jobs to have. I excelled at things like being a janitor because, well, I had co-founded a company and somebody needed to clean the bathroom. And that somebody just happened to be me. And I actually thought I was pretty good at it. I mean, it's more than just a plunger. It turns out there's a heck of a lot more to deal with in a public bathroom. I'm not going to get into the details, but I'll just say it is a hard job if you do it right. If you do it right, okay? So I'll throw that in there. Secondly, the busboy job that I had, I got fired from. And here's the best way to get fired from being a busboy. So this country club was in Midland, Michigan, where I grew up. And we had to reconfigure the event rooms, like these dining rooms, you know, and they had these air walls, okay, that separate the rooms and you can make them into smaller rooms, right? Yep. Well, these things had to be removed and carried into a storage facility, but they were heavy. I mean, really heavy. The sections of these walls were like 150 pounds each. So it was me and this other guy, and neither one of us were big, strong guys, but we were told we had to move that wall and it had to be done quick. So naturally, we do our best. We pick the thing up, we go running with it. There are people eating in the dining room that were slicing through at high speed. And as we go around the corner, there's a curved wall made out of sheetrock, curved sheetrock. And as I was turning, I decided to switch the way I was holding it at the same time that he did in the back. And that wall came down. It came down and went right through that curved wall and right into another room where people were processing back office paperwork and everything went flying. And I mean, it was just, and then of course, all the people who were eating, these are country club patrons, and they all decided they wanted to leave. I don't know why. Anyway, so it wasn't shortly thereafter I got a little talking to and I didn't have that job anymore. But that's just a long-winded way of saying sometimes getting that experience at all different levels will prepare you for some of the worst things that you encounter in other jobs that you would think are completely irrelevant. I mean, you know, being a startup CEO, you know, just a co-founder, you find yourself cleaning up all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's one disaster after another, really. I mean, that's what the world usually never sees. And then it's dropping walls through walls. I mean, that's sometimes you got to go crashing through walls and it's more to make stuff happen. So I realize that's metaphorical, but still it's terrorizing just the same.
Yeah. Does that mean that, you know, when you talk with your founders, are you, is it more about the journey or is it more about the destination?
I think that if you make it about the destination, you'll be disappointed the entire way there, because either you're not going to get there or the 10 years that it's spent getting there is going to be miserable. And that will decrease your chances of actually ever getting there. So you better make it about the journey. That's the way I look at it. And if you can't, then quit doing it because you're probably doing the wrong thing.
Right. Right. That's fantastic. I think there's a lot to be said about the journey when it comes to self-discovery. And something that we talk about with our founders constantly, right, is look, you have to start something. You have to really be passionate about that something. And generally when you do that, you'll get to that that finish line, you know, if you're meant to be, right? Bree, you're looking at me and I'm actually really excited because I know what's happening next.
Well, yes, we have a new segment because it's our first segment called VC Unboxing. And for this segment, we sent several items to Scott before the show taping. He has no idea as to what they are. So Scott, let's begin with the first box labeled F.
You got it. Okay, well, so any special instructions here, or do I just tear into this thing?
You tear into it, and then you can describe to the audience what it is that you have for those who are listening via podcast.
Exactly.
All right, here we go.
I'm excited.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Okay. Well,
and can you bring the box over and just let's see your face while you're doing this?
Yes. Yes. So this was the box. Okay. It looked like maybe. Like when they tell you, hey, Scott, here's your pink slip, and it's been nice working with you. This is the box that you get. Inside the box was this really, really fancy paper with some sparkly stuff on it. So I knew something exciting was going
to
be in there.
Thank
and
you,
lo and behold, lo and behold, there is a fanny pack with my alma mater, Salesforce, and the Lightning platform written on it. So I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this, but if you don't tell me, I'm just going to wear it proudly because this I've never had one of these.
We've got some ideas for you, Scott, actually.
Yeah, we absolutely do. First of all, I will just say that we're all proud wearers of this.
Oh, no. Oh, you've got to be kidding me.
Yes, we are. We are.
Wow.
So we want to take a trip together, and we even have one for Wei Ping so that we can all go together wearing our Salesforce fanny packs.
We are going to be the coolest people no matter where we are.
Absolutely.
I mean, I hope I really hope we go someplace like LA where, you know, fashion is king and, you know, people will truly recognize how cool this is. You know, how cool could it be to have Astro right here on your belt at all times?
Exactly.
So when you look at Astro and you see the Salesforce emblazoned fanny pack in front of you,
yes.
What are the first three things to come to your mind?
Well, because it just happens to say Lightning platform on it, okay? Mm-hmm. Lightning platform, without getting into the technical details of it, was a massive initiative to rebuild all of Salesforce basically from the ground up. It's just a small thing, you know? And it only happened about 15 years into the company's existence. So of course there was nothing really to rebuild after 15 years. You had to rebuild everything. And it was one of those moments where we all had to rethink the meaning of our lives and decide how in the heck were we gonna pull this off. And so, yeah, Lightning platform, that took many years of very painful work to get it there. I mean, finally, it is there. It exists. And, now that I see it, it doesn't give me that same feeling of shock and anxiety that it once did. I actually feel kind of good about it.
Fantastic. Fantastic. What is the second thing to pop into your mind?
Well, the second thing that pops into my mind is I didn't realize that Salesforce actually created such a thing. I mean, there was a lot of swag at Salesforce. And I mean, we had everything from pens to mugs to Boda bags to whatever, you know, you could think of, but I've never seen a fanny pack. So it makes me wonder, where did you get this? And is Salesforce going to come after you because you created it yourself?
No. So plug for my boyfriend Daniel's company, eBay. I just went on eBay and looked for the, you know, cheesiest Salesforce swag I could find. And this was it. I got a lot of 15 or even maybe more. So anyone out there who's looking for Salesforce fanny pack, email me and I will sell it to you so you can be as cool as Scott.
Well, the thing that just dawned on me is that somebody was selling 15 of these things on eBay.
Why? I don't even know. Lucky me.
But you bought them. Yeah, you bought them. So it worked.
I've never been more proud.
Good for that seller. Yeah.
I've never been more proud to wear a Salesforce swag than right now. It's, I mean, it's pretty fantastic.
So you met your wife at Salesforce. You want to tell us about interoffice dating in the, well, I guess it was in the 2010s?
Yeah, so, you know, it's not really a matter of interoffice dating. I think it's, but you know, we met 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, probably. And, you know, you got to keep it professional in the office. Yep. This is no joke. And things didn't really get serious until, you know, many years later. But it's always great. You look, and this is going to be me being serious for 1 second. Okay. I am a firm believer that if you want to have a great relationship with anyone, especially your significant other, always great to get to know each other first, mm-hmm. you know? You know, I mean, there's no better on-ramp to a great romantic relationship than being friends with somebody. And right. And there, obviously there's a fine line between the friend zone and the romance zone, but, and I think we all understand that, but that's kind of how it unfolded. And there was kind of this mutual respect, you know, I mean, I was on the product side and she was on the engineering side. So naturally she always thought that I never did anything. And I always thought she overanalyzed everything, but you know, we got past that.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I guess I have a follow-up question to that. I mean, you're alluding a little bit to company culture, right? And oftentimes when people hear Salesforce, they take the cult out of the culture and people say, oh gosh, Salesforce is a culture, it's this cult. Can you talk a little bit about, and you spent a lot of time at Salesforce, can you talk a little bit about what drove you, what enticed you about Salesforce? And then number two, what was your experience like over the course of your career at Salesforce, which was quite a long time? And did you feel any of those culty vibes or, you know, talk a little bit about that.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that question, but I'll do my best. So I joined Salesforce after nearly a 15-year run as a three-time entrepreneur. And after we sold our last company, I realized that I wanted to learn how to build a really big company, which I'd never built a billion-dollar company before. And I knew that Mark Benioff and Parker Harris, they had it figured. They were doing a lot right. And so I said, if nothing else, I would love to join this company and try to sort of reverse engineer or learn how they did it. Mm-hmm. So that I could walk away from that and either start another company or somehow otherwise parlay that into something else. And it turned out, my original plan was to be there for a couple of years, 2-3 years. And turned out there was no silver bullet to that question or the answer to that question. It was actually hundreds of things. But the one thing, whenever I get asked the question, what did you learn at Salesforce in those years? The one thing that I learned that really makes great companies great is the willingness to change on a dime. Even if things are working, the willingness to tear up the plan, whatever plan you got, and restart. And mm-hmm. Mark and
Lightning?
Team are, well, yeah, I mean, that's an example, right? I mean, the old Salesforce, you know, whole system and user interface and everything, it worked. Like companies, like there were 100,000 plus companies using it and they were successful using it, but we decided, hey, you know what, it was time. It was time for something new. It was time to refresh the whole thing. But I think it goes beyond that. It's like I could be running the, you know, a certain part of the business this year, and maybe we were really great at it that year. And then the next year, Mark says, okay, you're going to do something else. I'm like, but wait a minute. I'm in the middle of, you know, this is working. He said, exactly. That's why I need you to not get bored doing that. I want to inject new thoughts into this region, and I'm going to bring over somebody else good to take your old job. And then I'm thinking to myself, but what if that person's better than me? That's okay though. That's okay. It's part of the culture. It's part of the culture. And that's what I really, you know, all the companies that I work with now, I like to sort of share that sense of, don't worry. If just because things are working doesn't mean you shouldn't blow it up and try to reimagine yourself, because as soon as things are working well for a while, you're going to be blindsided, because it's not going to work one day. You got to plan for what is coming or what you don't even see coming. And that's the one thing the Salesforce did really, really well. And I guess the second part to your question was really around, you know, what did I take away, or, you know, what were some of the highlights, I think is what you were trying to get at. Am I right? Yeah. So Salesforce, and you mentioned cult. So I'm just going to call that word out, because I don't want to dodge the question here.
No, don't do that.
The best thing about any company that you want to stay working for is that you actually have some emotional connection to the company. And a lot of people in, you know, if you want to use the word cult, they have some emotional connection to whatever that organization is that people consider a cult. Now, I don't consider Salesforce to be a cult, but the one thing that you can pull out of all that is people have like this faith. Like, you go to Dreamforce and the customers couldn't care less about the product. They are all in on the company, the culture, the people, and the feeling, like that vibe, you know? It's like, how do you have a $20 billion enterprise B2B software company that gives you a good feeling, a good vibe, you know? Oh, it's Stevie Wonder's playing, and then you got Bruno Mars, and then you got the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you got Mark getting up on stage and just like ranting and raving about how cool this B2B stuff is gonna be, and people are getting up and cheering. I mean, it's just this amazing energy that the company created. And yes, it was hard to leave it. Does that mean it was a cult? I don't think so, but I see. I mean, they use words like Ohana, you know, to say it's family, you know, the Salesforce family. I think that's healthy. There's nothing wrong with that. And I can never say anything bad about that company, because I truly loved working there. It was just time for me to try something new.
Can so number one, let's then officially dispel this notion that Salesforce is trying to build a cult, and applaud Salesforce for building the type of culture that is almost like boy band-esque in terms of bringing energy and excitement.
We're talking like New Direction or Backstreet Boys.
I think we're talking about BTS. Let's get real.
Ooh.
I think this is BTS in a sense that they're out for doing right, and they're excited about inclusion, right? And I think that's big. I don't know. So it's really admirable. Do you think, just as a short aside, you mentioned Mark Benioff, and he's obviously a big part of this and building the culture, et cetera. Do you think he's pissed off at the Boogaloos for taking the Hawaiian shirt as their uniform?
I don't think much rattles Mark Benioff, honestly. And the one thing I can say about him is, you see what you see is what you get. Here's an example. So you see him talk about philanthropy, you see him talk about these 1-1-1 model, you know, giving back and volunteering and all this good stuff, and you see him in the press, you see him on TV, and you think, or Mad Money or whatever, and you think, you know, he's just saying that. I've been behind closed doors in meetings with him. He is the same guy in that environment that he is on TV. And that's, I think that's one of the more remarkable things about him. And I know a lot of other CEOs, and I've met a few billionaires in my life, mostly by accident, because I don't know how I snuck in the back door, but they usually, and I'm generalizing, but you know, money gets to people's heads, you know, but Mark actually, you know, again, I'm not trying to just shower him with praise here. I'm just saying, you know, like he's a real dude. And that's pretty hard to find, I think, especially in Silicon Valley.
So I want to move back to you, as much as I love talking about Benioff. This is about the Scott Bechuk show tonight. I want to talk about some of the startups you've invested in and kind of your own philosophy. I know you've invested in Leanplum, which maximizes customer engagement, LTV, MindTickle is with sales training. We're CFOs. We love what you invest in because it ultimately helps the CAC to LTV ratio. Tell us more about how your time at Salesforce shaped your now investing focus on what I would like to call the customer journey.
That's a great question because it's one of the reasons why I thought maybe then was a good time to leave. I had this general thought. I was coming off of almost 7 years at Salesforce. And the one thing that stuck with me was that all of a sudden, brands were becoming more human. And that was a really, really major like brain shift for me. I'm like, wow. So personalization, which is what we were talking about in the 90s, is now actually based on big, big data sets about, you know, learning about me as a consumer or me as an employee, right? And now brands can actually have more of a personal relationship. They can actually build a relationship with their customers, just as companies can build better relationships with their employees. And so the one thing that I walked away from Salesforce thinking about was if CRM was the last 20 years and it, you know, understanding your customer was one of the most important things you could do, what's next? Like, what do we do with all that data, right? And what are all the companies going to look like over the next 10 to 15 to 20 years that are going to use customer information in a responsible privacy, honoring your privacy type of manner, but create better experiences, more personalized experiences. I'm thinking about my inbox. There's this company called Bluecore that I invested in New York, and their job is to reduce the amount of garbage that you get from retailers because every retailer in the world wants you to buy all their stuff, right? But Bluecore says, forget about that. What we're going to do is we're going to understand you as a person and we're going to allow all our brands to become more human in understanding you and what we think you really would like. And we're going to use AI to constantly learn and get smarter about those things that you like. And every time that you reach out, that one of their customers, one of their biggest customers is Nike, for example, whenever Nike reaches out to you about a new pair of shoes or joggers or whatever it is, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to go, hey, I've been looking for that, you know, and it's kind of magic. And that magic isn't real magic. It's just data science. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I walked away from Salesforce realizing was that we're entering a new world where systems of record become less important or they remain important, but systems of intelligence become far more important because that's what creates that human to human or human to brand relationship. And younger generations, they take it for granted. I mean, if you reach out to them and you spam their inbox, they barely check in their email anyway. So it better be personal.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love to hear that. Well, let's move on to our second box because I know we don't have a ton of time. So let's do the second one labeled P.
Okay, P, here it comes.
Yo. And I'm also going to encourage
Bree, this one's heavier.
Not to drink nearly as much as I have drunk.
Oh my God.
Becky, what is in this box? This is a grand piano.
Yeah.
A handheld grand. This is incredible.
It's a baby grand.
This is, it's like a baby's baby grand.
Yeah,
like,
it's a fetus grand.
Yeah. This is tiny. This is an amazing instrument. I've never seen anything like this. It's a full grand piano, meaning like somehow they've constructed this thing with a microphone even attached. So it's almost like a karaoke system, if you will. This is really something.
We are excited that you are so excited, but even more so, can you please turn that thing on? There's a little button at the top there.
Well, okay, let's see here.
Perfect. So a very little known fact about you is that music wasn't just a side hustle for you. Of course, you were a piano teacher, but you really made a profession alongside of your day job. So what we'd love for you to do, not to put you on the spot, but maybe if you could play us a couple of keys, if you will.
Yeah. Well, let's see here. I don't know. Can you hear this?
Nice.
Love it.
This is, you know what? I hate to say it, Norwest, but I'm going to have to take a few days off. I got some work to do because this is going on a record. I don't know what record, but, and I hope to goodness that I don't use this microphone right here because nobody ever wants to hear me sing. Unfortunately, in a few karaoke bars they have, but we're just going to forget about that. But this is a very cool instrument, and thank you for this.
Well, you're welcome. We'd love to hear about what type of musicians inspire you.
It's a broad category. I love jazz a lot. I love jazz. I think some of the most creative music in the last century has been created by people who were the music theory behind jazz playing, because it's structure, it's mathematics, it's improvisation. So, you know, I maybe it's just me and I'm sloppy, because I like jazz because nobody ever knows if I'm wrong.
Right.
Like you can, I mean, sure, it might sound a little strange, but who's to say that it's wrong if it's improvising?
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. We were talking about this earlier. Bree and I were talking about improv and, you know, first episode jitters for our podcast. And I think, you know, it's something to keep in mind, right? I think there's something very beautiful about doing something on the fly and having to kind of put your brain through that function of, okay, how do I create in that moment, right? Versus how do I create for a moment?
And yes, well, I will say that the most terrifying moment I ever had as a musician is when I played a piano bar, and this is part of the way I paid through my way through undergrad. And somebody asked me to play. I had a book of about 500 songs that I knew how to play. But, oh, sorry, this thing's playing by itself over here. Let me turn that off. One of the songs that was not in the book, these were called fake books, was a song that a group of 40-something-year-olds who had a friend who had just turned 40 at the bar, okay, it was a bar and a restaurant, they wanted me to play Happy Birthday. And it seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to ask, except I didn't know Happy Birthday. Of all these songs, I didn't know it.
It's a copyright infringement anyway, Scott. You can't play it at a restaurant. Did you know that?
I didn't know. And quite
frankly, $1 million royalty fee to play Happy Birthday in public.
Well, you know, with that fee, I could have bought that entire place in Midland, Michigan. But that's beside the fact. I tried it. I had no music in front of me. I was playing it by ear, which again sounds like a great idea if you're playing jazz because nobody knows. But when it's a song that people know and they're singing along to and you don't know what you're doing, they really notice. I mean, that is a dramatic moment when they all 15 people turn their heads at the piano player and look at me like, why are you ruining our lives? And I'm only like, you know, 18, 19 years old. I am petrified. I make my way through the song somehow. I get to the end. I step away and I go into this tells you how old I am. I step into a phone booth, okay? And I make a call to somebody that I trust. And I'm like, my music career is over. I'm never going to get hired again. That was it. I thought that was it.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday almost ruined my entire musical life.
And then you moved on to becoming a DJ. What was that like?
Well, I actually never learned how to be a DJ. I had a group. It was a two-person group where I played keyboards alongside a DJ.
Oh.
And so we wrote a lot of our own. It was mostly house music. And for about 10 years, we played together, did a lot of stuff around San Francisco. And we wrote a lot of our own stuff. The funny thing about music, and especially like house music and electronic music, is that most people who hear it think, oh, that guy knows what he's doing. What a great composer. The truth is, I'm not that great at all. I was never that good. In fact, I know how to program a computer into making it sound like I know what I'm doing sometimes. And then, you know, there's like all kinds of effects and like magic you can pull. And one thing leads to another and you got this vinyl record that you can put down and then I can play alongside it. And people are like, that guy's a genius. I wasn't. Nobody, I mean, I wasn't. There are some geniuses out there. I mean, there are some, like Disclosure, I mean, Moby. I mean, there's some really, really talented electronic musicians out there. I wasn't one of them. But the secret to doing all this is not telling anybody that you don't know what you're doing. And we actually managed to get booked all over the world. We played 20 countries with that, with not knowing what we were doing.
What was the craziest travel story when you were going through those 20 countries?
Well, the craziest one I can think of is when we flew from the Moscow on a 1972 Soviet era plane into Siberia. It was a 5.5 hour flight in the middle of the winter. And the plane had an engine problem while we were flying there. It started to sputter. And there was a Russian pilot over the intercom telling us something. And I figured it was probably, we're all gonna die. But the plane managed to survive. All the oxygen masks kept coming down, but that's just because the plane was so old that the doors holding them were loose. And then every time the plane would slow down, all the empty seats would fall forward. So the plane would slow down and half the plane would just, anyway, we landed in 3 feet of snow because they didn't plow the runway in Tomsk, Siberia. And I didn't know it was 3 feet of snow until I got out in my sneakers and was trudging through on the jetway to get to the airport, or there was no jetway. And that's when I knew that this is not going to be a normal gig. This was going to be a very, very weird weekend, which it was, in the middle of Siberia. I mean, we were hundreds of miles away from civilization. We were in the frozen tundra. I mean, seriously, I if I didn't come back from that trip, even to this day, no one would ever know where I was. I promise you.
How many people were at the concert?
Well, Tomsk is a little known town in the middle of Siberia that happens to be a university town. And so there's about, I don't know, maybe about 100,000 people in the whole town. And this club filled up with 2,000 people, believe it or not. It was like this 5-story club, and everything was going great until we accidentally shut the power off and the place went dark. And I was really worried. The owner of the club walked up to the stage. I thought that was it. I was never getting home. I was gonna be thrown out in the middle of the wilderness and some big bear was gonna get me. These were the thoughts that were going through my mind. This is the first time I'd ever been to Siberia. I mean, who goes to Siberia? Much less to play a gig.
That is a come to Jesus moment if you've ever had one.
Oh man, I was praying to every God I knew the name of.
Speaking of gods, and we know that you're so heavy into music, and that's really like a lifeblood for yourself. I mean, how does music influence your spirituality and what you're about?
Spirituality is, I guess, different for everybody, isn't it? It's kind of how you lead your life is the way I look at it. And I'm not a super religious person, but I would say that if you had to look at the spiritual side of how I view the world and how it's more about how you treat people, I think. And it's really about, you know, I'm gonna get myself into a little bit of an embarrassing situation right now by bringing this up. But in the early to mid 90s, there was this term in the rave scene called PLUR, P-L-U-R. And it stood for peace, love, understanding, and respect. Unity, sorry. Peace, love, unity, and respect. And despite the fact that it has become this multi-decade cliche ever since then, I think there's something to it, right? And I know anybody who watches this, you know, is gonna be probably just rolling their eyes and saying, oh, this guy's a burned out raver. But the truth is, like, what is spirituality, right? And I'm not a burner. I've never been to Burning Man. I would go. I would totally go. I just haven't. But I think there's something to that. It's like, how do you treat people? And how much praise do you dole out every day? And how do you make people feel? Do you really, really, truly respect and show how much you respect people and how much you care about people in life? And if you do that, I feel that's a form of spirituality. And it's definitely a way of looking at life And it's part of what I try to keep reminding myself is what should guide us all.
There are a lot of people that look at venture capitalists and will listen to this and something, there's going to be a disconnect. Like, there's a venture capitalist talking about love and respect and unity. And I thought they were all just, you know, Bobby Axelrods of the world in billions.
Billions.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, you know, for me as a venture capitalist, there is this like weird, visceral, appealing nature to Bobby Axelrod. And everything from the ayahuasca trips to, you know, just hell-bent on doing something, right? He does it.
Well, he's a disgusting human being that should be despised for a lot of reasons. But I think there's a silver lining to that guy. You can see, I don't know how many people have watched all five seasons, but every once in a while you get a glimpse of a little bit of real heart and soul in that guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's there, right? I don't aspire to be him by any stretch, but since you brought him up.
Yeah.
Let's
talk about people who you aspire to be. I think you've talked to me about Bill Gates and Melinda Gates specifically. You've talked to me about Richard Branson, Boyant Salute. These are all folks that are sort of labeled as techno-optimists. And
well, I mean, Boyant Slide, I don't know if he's an optimist. I think maybe he is. He's very young. And he's the guy who's running out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with this contraption that he devised to clean up the Pacific garbage patch. And he started this when he was like 19 years old or maybe even younger. I think he's Dutch and he's amazing. I had a chance to meet him one time. You know, just like very inspiring to see somebody who, by the way, when I was 19 years old, I was just trying to figure out, you know, how I was ever going to graduate undergrad, you know, and I probably, you know, probably had a beer in one hand and my unfinished, you know, essay that I was supposed to write for the next day in the other hand. And meanwhile, this guy's going and he's changing the world and it's starting to work. So, I mean, how can you not be inspired by a guy like that? And I don't know if he's an optimist. I mean, I think he's a realist.
Yeah. How does a techno-optimist, it's really hard being in venture and being an optimist. I mean, how does the techno-optimist in you sort of manifest yourself in day to day, even given all of the fires that you need to put out and explosions that happen on the day to day of what you do?
Well, I think venture capital and investing, I think, is mostly about people. I think the companies and the technologies are a byproduct of good people doing good things, hopefully. And so the optimistic side of me would say, the relationships that you build with people in, you know, certainly in venture and building great companies, this is about organizations. And there, I've yet to see a really great company be built with a bunch of a-holes. You can't create a company where people don't treat other people correctly. I mean, even in a really, really tough environment, like the early days of Apple, for example, where Steve would just turn the screws really hard on people. I mean, the culture within Apple was certainly influenced a lot by Steve, but there was this positive energy around innovation, right? Where people, it was almost like a collegial thing where they just felt, you know, they were all in the same mission and there was like this very positive spirit. And in, you know, when they were pulling all-nighters, you know, night after night after night, which is the same thing that happens in many startups, it's really about those relationships and the trust that you build with people. And so for me, the optimism comes from there are good people in this world and who want to do great things. And the best companies, this is a little cliche, but it's never about the money. It's never about the outcome. We were talking about the journey before. And so if you truly enjoy what you're doing and you're doing it for the right reasons and you treat people right while you're building those companies, I think that's a lot to be optimistic about. Even if you fail, you probably learned a lot and you built some really good, you know, some friends and some trusted relationships that you're probably going to carry forward for a really long time. So I think that's a huge part of it.
I'm ready for a top off. How about you guys? Anyone need a little top off here?
Absolutely. Well, you know, this tea that I've been drinking has been delicious, but it does have so much caffeine. I'm worried about staying up all night. So I'm going to have to switch to whiskey.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. After you top off, let's get to the next book, the one that says B.
Okay, I'm ready and able. And by the way, thanks for making it so easy for me here. I mean, this is like a VC instruction guide exactly for the type of person that I am. I get lost in long documents. I get confused by tech specs, and I can't, a P&L that has too many numbers in it just makes me run the other way. But this stack of boxes over here, this is a piece of cake.
It's like Christmas morning.
Oh man.
And any of those, you can send those P&Ls over our way.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? We've had the blessing of working with many Brooklyn and Associates CFOs over the years. And I've got to say, lifesavers, absolute yes. Lifesavers.
We love to hear it.
Okay. Oh my God. Oh no, you didn't. Okay. Well, first of all, there's some more really exciting, like highly colorful and dynamic, sparkly paper in there. But what they've done is they've zeroed in on a side of me that is a little bit dangerous to talk about. And it has to do with Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh yeah.
We got two of these incredible books that are remarkably hard to read, because I don't know what exactly state of mind he was in when he wrote them, but the words and the sentences, it's almost reading like Dante's Inferno, except that there's not thousands of years of history behind every word and phrase.
Right.
Well, thank you. This is going to be good reading. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was one of my favorites, and it's a classic. It made a great movie too. Johnny Depp was out of this world.
Yeah.
We're hoping one will fit in your fanny pack there, so you can take it as some vacation reading.
I'll make it work. I will make it work.
We didn't think about putting Plur candy into the fanny pack.
Okay, we should probably stop talking about Plur, you know, from here on out. You know, or you don't have to just name it. We don't have to use the term Plur, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to get razzed a lot for that one. I know it.
You know what?
We'll edit that out.
We'll edit it out.
We'll edit that out.
Or at the very least, I'll just say, I think Bree and I are we have your backs there. But there's nothing wrong with Plur.
Okay.
You make me feel better.
It's good. It's like what do they call that? The Stockholm syndrome, when you know your captors suddenly make you feel okay about the things that are happening to you. I'm okay with
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
I feel good now.
So you were Hunter S. Thompson for Halloween one year. What made you go with the costume decision? Because Halloween's coming up.
It is. And I don't know what you guys are doing for Halloween. Do you have any plans?
I'll be in Yosemite.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I'm helping my three youngest nieces and nephews trick-or-treat around the Reno area in a socially distanced and responsible way.
Okay. That's good. Great. Well, you know, I might pull out the Hunter S. Thompson outfit again, because I never actually wore it for Halloween. I got it halfway through the season. And why did I choose it? Well, I mean, despite the fact that he does many, many illegal things that I would never consider doing in my life, I like the spirit of just the willingness to go out there and explore and just at a moment's notice, pack up and go and have an adventure. And so for this Halloween, I've decided to do just that. We are going to go down to Burlingame to the drive-in movie theater, where there is a live concert of pure improvised music by an artist named Marc Ribier. Now, if you don't know Marc Ribier, I would advise that you go on YouTube, check him out. If you're easily offended, maybe don't. but he is an amazingly talented guy. He's a jazz pianist. He plays drums. He plays guitar. He plays everything. And he records it on the spot, overlays it, overdubs it. And then he sings. And when he sings, he has this look of like, kind of like a 1970s guy with a mustache. And, you know, just like he wears sometimes he'll wear a kimono or a bathrobe. And halfway through the show, that thing comes off and he's got tighty whities, but he is belting it out like a gospel singer. I mean, the sound that comes out of his mouth, you wouldn't believe it.
Is he local?
He's not, he's from New York.
Oh, okay.
But he is an absolute, and he is the example, by the way, and I of what we can do now. You don't have to, in order to become a world famous, selling out concerts, brand new musician, you can do it all on Instagram now. That's mm-hmm. exactly how he did it. He built his entire millions and millions of fans all on Facebook Live and Instagram streaming. And I mean, this guy, if you're really easily offended, he doesn't really say that much offensive stuff. But he curses here and there. Okay. So that's about the level of it. I'd say it's mostly family friendly, but we're going to go out there. We'll be all dressed up. It's going to be a parking lot party. And my wife and I are thrilled. We've been listening to him. He does a Sunday morning show live stream every Sunday. So good thing to tune into.
We will put the link to his music somewhere in the podcast when it's published. I've seen a few of his episodes. He doesn't like to wear a lot of clothing on his.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He starts in a robe and he ends up, you know, he gets really into it. You know, like one guy making the music of an entire band, it's exhausting. I mean, he's running two marathons in that concert.
It sounded pretty incredible. I think if it wasn't for copyright issues, we'd probably lead in and exit this podcast with that music.
We could reach out. We'll find out.
We can reach out.
It might be okay.
Should we start with our next segment?
Yeah. So we have a next segment. This one is called This or That. It's a segment where we're going to show you two things, Scott, and you have to choose which one you'd prefer. Okay. So let me go ahead and share my screen and let's get started.
Okay.
So
going into presentation mode.
Yeah, presentation mode. Look at this. Okay. So This or That, Scott B. Chuck edition. Let's get started with the first one. Who would you invest in? Wendy Rhodes or Taylor? What's her last name?
Taylor Mason.
Taylor Mason.
Well, you know, I love both of them, but I would invest in Taylor Mason in a heartbeat because she is one of the most brilliant characters on TV. I think she's not just an amazing actress, but her character, she's quant, she's she's political. She's super high IQ, super high EQ. Absolutely brilliant. Love her.
Agreed. She's like my spirit animal. Okay. Which would you rather attend, EDC or Burning Man?
Oh man. Well, I'm going to have to go with Burning Man on this one, even though I've never done it, because EDC is something that I have experienced. I've performed in similar situations. And while that was really great, you know, in my 20s and early 30s, I think if I did ever, and this is something my wife and I have talked about a little bit, is could we do Burning Man? And if we did, how would we do it? I don't want to be one of those guys who, you know, shows up in like one of these, you know, fancy, you know, I don't know, what do they call those things? You know, like 5-star hotels that they build there. I kind of want to do it the right way. But it's a huge time commitment. So we'll see. I love the artwork. In fact, she and I go to Burning Man art exhibitions throughout the year. So we're super into that stuff. So that's my choice.
All right. Well, if you go, I'll make you a costume of Salesforce fanny packs and you'll be the star of Burning Man.
Well, I might just get thrown out. I'm not sure what the rules are there, but that might be the only rule that you're just not allowed to do that.
No, I mean, honestly, maybe it's just one fanny pack. Not multiple fanny, just
Vic, just look, one. Man, if you want to join me and rock that one fanny pack, that I feel like that's more your jam.
We'll make it a burner crew. We'll make it the Salesforce Lightning Fanny Pack Burner Crew.
Absolutely.
All right. Which Adam Sandler movie? Happy Gilmore or The Wedding Singer?
Happy Gilmore every day. Every day. In fact, when I say every day, I mean every day. I've seen that movie over 200 times, and that is not an exaggeration. The Wedding Singer is just fine, but Happy Gilmore is so much more classic for me.
Okay, conference food buffet preference, sushi or dim sum?
Oh, I'm going to have to go with dim sum. I love sushi. It's probably one of my favorite foods in the world, but conference sushi is not the same as any other sushi you might otherwise seek out. Dim sum, on the other hand, is pretty hard to screw up.
Yeah,
we were trying to trick you up on this one because we know you love sushi, but we also know conference buffet sushi is the nastiest thing you've ever had. So are you willing to eat it? I guess no.
That's like, it's like 2 day old sushi.
Ugh, nasty.
Nobody
all right.
Needs that.
Our final bowl cut Scotty or Super Bowl hopeful Scotty?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, this is not really for me to judge. This is more for you to judge.
And I would like to just say, let's pause for a second. I want to tell the listeners what we're looking at right now. On the left, Scott, can you please describe for me what we're looking at and what age you were when this photo was taken?
Well, first of all, I was going for the smallest collars that I could find in the 70s. And those were it. They didn't make collars. They did not make collars smaller than that. And no. So I'll just throw that out there. So that'll give you a slight hint as to what age I might have been.
Okay.
I'm gonna go with 5 in that picture.
5-year-old Scott with a wide disco-like white collar, and one cannot miss the maroon vest that you're wearing over that.
And I mean, I obviously had to undo the top button because the chest hair was an important aspect of the disco era.
Yes, yes. You were
and
channeling...
as a 5-year-old, I had aspirations, but I just didn't have the ability.
You were channeling your inner John Travolta, if I may.
Yes, yes. I didn't have the dance moves, but I was going for the look.
But he knew he would be a future VC. Because he wore the vest.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. I didn't even think of that. Wow. And you know what? That was actually my parents probably somehow programming my brain by putting me in that vest.
And
I didn't have any choice over what I wore.
And did 5-year-old you get a free bowl of soup to go with that haircut?
The soup would come after the haircut, not before. Otherwise, I think my hair would look even worse than it does right there, if you can imagine.
All right. Okay. And then on the right-hand side, we have you, I'd like to say 10, 11 years old. You've got Detroit Lions gear on and stuffed animals, including maybe a Wile E. Coyote.
Good eye.
Is this when you thought, you know, the Detroit Lions might have been heading to the Super Bowl and you, this was hopeful?
Well, first of all, I don't think anyone ever in the history of the Detroit Lions ever assumed they were going to the Super Bowl. I think 1954, if I recall correctly, was the last year when they had anything to really celebrate.
That's true.
Barry Sanders, as I've mentioned before, was a highlight.
Yep.
But we really can't zero in on much more. That didn't stop me, though, from wearing those tube socks. Check those things out.
Those are fantastic. Really. And frankly, the jerseys, they should probably go back to those jerseys.
In that size.
Maybe in that size. But this brings us back to, would you take bowl cut Scotty? Or would you choose Super Bowl hopeful Scotty to go back to if you could generate a machine and go back in time?
Well, you know what? Because of the absolute disregard for my look entirely, I would go back to disco Scott, bowl cut Scott, because, you know, isn't that what life is all about? I mean, we shouldn't focus too much. We shouldn't over rotate on our looks, should we? It should be more about who we are. And you can tell in that picture, I was thinking very deeply about the future of technology.
Piercing eyes, really.
That is true. I think they look photoshopped.
They really do.
Photoshop was a mere sparkle in someone's eye back in those days. But yes, and so were computers, for that matter.
It's all true. All right. So I think that ends our segment, This or That. And I know we have two more things. We have a box, I'm sure you know, is sitting there. And Vic.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we obviously need to celebrate the absurdity of playing this game, This or That. And to that extent, we have a final parting gift. Let's move to box labeled V for victory.
The V box. Okay. Yes. I'm gonna get in there. Here it is. This one actually says specifically, do not open.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Whoa, oh, this one's pink on the inside. So this one, uh-oh. Oh, you've got to be kidding me. You're not going to believe this. Oh, it's not only is it a Patagonia vest, but it is my favorite music festival. It was such a success. I love being on the beach in the Bahamas. Actually, I didn't go, but I wish I had.
Now you get to be the only VC with a Fyre Festival vest.
This is arguably one of the coolest things I'll own. It really is. I mean, think about this. How many people are running around the world celebrating the most disastrous music festival that ever occurred? In fact, if you did go to the Fyre Festival, I mean, I feel terribly sorry for you and your soul, but you probably wouldn't be wearing this. Because I just don't think he walked away with a great feeling about it. There was probably a bonfire somewhere with these in it.
I will probably wear it. Put it on now. Show it off.
All right.
I know it's a wardrobe staple of yours. At least I think you've inspired future segments of ours to who wore it better with, you know, Patagonia vests. But this is exciting.
Oh, yeah. It even matches what you're wearing. Wow, that looks great.
I feel this is very natural. It just, for some reason, I feel like this has always been part of me, this vest.
Do you think that Wei Ping likes us more or less for getting you this vest?
I think she's probably halfway to Oregon by now. I think I heard the car starting, and I'm pretty sure she's gone. And it's gonna take me a while to find her after this. I'm not sure she approves of any of this, but on the other hand, I have this now, and so all I got to do is FaceTime her, no matter where she is, and say, "Yeah, I know, but look at this."
Yeah. Oh man, I mean, the look on your face.
Thank you. By the way, this is absolutely just shocking. I never had any idea it was going to get this involved, and it's. What a blessing to be here with you and to be wearing this Patagonia vest that I never thought I would own, nor did anyone else think they would ever own.
And no one ever will own that except for you.
It's a one of a kind.
You mean this is a one of a kind?
It is.
Are you kidding?
Nope.
Really? Oh man. Oh, I got to be really careful not to spill anything on this. Wow. Okay. Whew.
Well,
I'm feeling a little warm in this right now.
Well, we're glad you like it.
Thank you. I love it.
We only wish that people that attended Fyre Island could have been that warm at night. They just didn't have any bedding or tent.
Anything. They probably would have wished there were sleeves on it, but I mean, this would have been a good start for sure.
Look, Scott, I mean, this has been an absolute blast. I feel like you've set the bar extremely high for all of our future guests.
I appreciate you saying that. And the fact that there is a bar is a huge, huge plus here. And by the way, Bree, your bar behind you is absolutely killer. I mean,
it's thanks to COVID.
What a nice collection.
for any VCs that care that are listening or watching, we do a lot of drinking events at Berkland, and that is how I've stocked my bar. So I would love to have any other VCs listening. Hit us up. We'd love to have you, and we'll fill your bar as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, well, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Scott, you've spoiled us a tradition that we're starting as this is our first episode. We'd love to give our host or our guest, excuse me, the honor of giving the last toast. And it's your 20 seconds to promote a startup, talk about your wife, whatever you want. The floor is yours for 20 seconds. And toasting to you, and we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, the thing that I think is the most important in 2020 is acknowledging, again, this is going to get a little bit serious, but this is true. And it's truly how I feel. I want to acknowledge all of the frontline healthcare workers who have absolutely given up everything to help us get through this almost impossible year. Almost everything in 2020 that I can remember has been unexpected. And some of it's been incredibly challenging. There's so much loss this year, but without that dedication, that selflessness, and just giving up everything to help us make it through this all around the world, I'd like to do this toast to the frontline healthcare workers during the pandemic. Thank you so much for your service.
Here, here. Cheers.
Drink to that. Well, thank you. And I guess this ends our first episode of Drinks with a VC.
Real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, guys.